And of course, now for the next couple hours, we're going to talk about the supernatural. Chris Putnam joins us back on Coast to Coast AM in a moment. So get ready. And welcome back. Chris Putnam with us again. Chris was on with me back in March of last year. Chris is a paranormal investigator, also recognized for his expertise in the area of prophecy and prophetic traditions. His latest work, The Supernatural Worldview, proposes that Western culture was in the midst of a paranormal paradigm shift and that the paranormal is the new normal. Chris, I like that. Welcome back. How have you been?
Hey, George, it's great to be on the show with you. I'm doing great, and just excited to talk to you tonight.
Hey, a lot of response when you were on with me last year about Petrus Romanus, and gosh, you know what? I still think we're in this apocalyptic position here.
Yeah, I really do agree with that. I think that, nobody knows the day or the hour, but we're certainly in the last days.
That's kind of scary, isn't it?
Well, you know, I think that kind of depends on your position with the Lord and you know, how comfortable you feel about that. For many of us, it's exciting because, you know, we really do look forward to the return of Christ.
Tell me about the jump into the paranormal, or should I say the supernatural?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what the book is about. It's called The Supernatural Worldview, and, you know, I'm writing from a Christian perspective, but, you know, what I found, George, is that even a lot of Christians don't really have a supernatural worldview. They kind of have this view of God who is transcendent, and, of course, he's the ultimate supernatural being. But then, you know, everyone exists in their daily life kind of in the natural world. So there's this whole area that I kind of label the excluded middle, which would include spirits and angels and demons and things of that nature. And even, you know, most people who claim to have a supernatural worldview don't really live that way, it seems like, large majority of the time. And that could be problematic. What I've noticed is that the culture at large is really, you know, adopting the paranormal as the new normal. I mean, I think it's evident just from the sorts of things we see on television. I mean, a few decades ago, you know, ghost hunters, and now we have dozens of shows with people out hunting ghosts and paranormal phenomena, and that would have been unheard of, you know, just a few decades ago. So it's really becoming common, and yet, you know, there's a kind of inconsistency I found with a lot of my Christian brothers and sisters who don't really have much room for those sorts of things in their worldview. So it's kind of an interesting contradiction there.
And when we talk about the paranormal being normal, when did that shift occur?
You know, I guess most scholars who look at this sort of thing would probably say during the 1960s, you know, there was kind of an explosion of occult books and things like that started coming out, and people started getting into Eastern spirituality. And, of course, the Beatles, you know, brought their gurus over and things like that. So it probably began then, but it's kind of expanded since. And you know, it's sort of been adopted by culture at large, and really, you know, what they used to call the New Age and things like that, that was kind of on the fringe, is so commonplace now that it's pretty accepted. I mean, if you look at the kind of spiritual ideas that Oprah Winfrey promotes, they're mainstream, and that used to be kind of edgy New Age stuff, and now it's just kind of mundane.
You have looked at a number of areas of the supernatural, near-death experiences being one of them. What have you concluded, Chris, about that?
Well, I think, you know, when I was writing this book, you know, a large part of my hypothesis, my thesis about this paranormal paradigm shift is that, you know, naturalism has been the dominant worldview that's promoted in the universities. This idea that nature explains everything, that all of reality boils down to matter and physics and chemistry. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's becoming discredited. And the near-death experience is really one of the most compelling and exciting kinds of evidence against it. Now, the thing that's really interesting to me is what they call the veridical near-death experience. Most people who study these kind of divide them into two aspects. The veridical, that's just kind of a fancy word that means it has corroboration, that it matches, you know, that it has factual elements that you can document. And then the transcendental would be the more mystical part of the experience, where people describe heaven and seeing, you know, all this kind of scenery in heaven and butterflies and all kinds of kind of subjective things that are really hard to nail down and you can't really prove them. But the veridical accounts have a this-worldly aspect that you can verify, and there's a growing body of these, and they really, really prove that you are not just your brain. So, you know, the naturalist worldview, the skeptic kind of concludes that humans, that consciousness is just sort of an epiphenomenon, as they mm-hmm. were to use, of the brain, that consciousness emerges from, you know, these neural networks in your brain. But there's some cases where people describe out-of-body experiences that just don't make any sense within a naturalistic framework. Would you like me to describe one of those cases?
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely.
I think the gold standard of veridical NDEs is really the one that centers on a singer-songwriter. Her name was Pam Reynolds. And the thing that makes this case so compelling is that it actually happened during surgery. So she was hooked up to all kinds of equipment that would monitor her consciousness and whatnot. So it really kind of bypasses most of the skeptical objections that you'd usually hear. So she had an exotic surgical procedure. They actually called it Operation Standstill. It was to remove a life-threatening aneurysm on her brainstem. Now, it was in such a precarious location that they had to stop her heart and drain all the blood out of her brain to allow the aneurysm to be removed. Jeez. So even more, you know, to do this, they had to lower her body temperature to 60 degrees, fully anesthetize her, and then they put sound-emitting earplugs in her ears to verify that she had flat brainwave activity on an EEG. So there's really no way to argue that she was semi-conscious and able to perceive things, because they actually had these earplugs emitting a sound, you know, and monitoring it to make sure it was flatline. So she describes waking up and watching the doctor sawing her skull cap open, you know, causing her to realize that she's observing herself from over his shoulder. Now, you know, she goes on to describe the surgical saw that he was using, it looking like an electric toothbrush, you know, and coming from something that looked like a socket wrench case. And she described it in some detail. And in fact, the doctor that I read the account from, Dr. Michael Sabaw, he's a cardiologist who interviewed her, and he didn't really believe her description because he'd never seen a bone saw like she was talking about. And he actually called the manufacturer and got pictures of it, and it was exactly as she described. And, you know, it was even more amazing is that she described the conversations that were going on between the doctors as they were operating on her. She was able to relate. You know, the doctor down at my feet remarked that my veins were really small, so the one up at the shoulder told him to move the catheter from the left leg to the right leg. Now, you know, when she awoke from the surgery and described this conversation, you know, the doctors in the operating room were just astounded because she got it exactly right. Those statements were verified by the personnel that were there. You know, how is that explicable? You know, apart from her actually observing her operation at a time when her heart was stopped, the blood was drained out of her brain, and her EEG was completely flat. I mean, it really does seem to demonstrate that there is an immaterial you, you know, what we've classically called the soul, that exists apart from the body, and that, you know, your mind is really not your brain. Your brain is more just like a piece of hardware that allows you to interface between the immaterial and the material.
And Chris, did you always believe that the soul was there? I mean, being as spiritual as you are, I assume you did.
Yeah, George, I think so. You know, I think most people sort of intuitively believe that. And I think that, you know, if you just sort of think about consciousness and self-awareness, it is intuitive to most people. I mean, you know, just some kind of simple exercise, like, you know, if I told you to imagine an elephant or a pink elephant even, you know, you could easily picture that, right?
Sure, of course.
Okay, but where is the pink elephant? I mean, if I were to dissect your brain, would I find a pink elephant? No. So where is it? You know, it's kind of like your mind. It's something that it's not exactly physical. It's not your brain. There is a non-physical you, and I think we all intuitively are aware of that.
When you look at and weigh the difference between the supernatural and the paranormal, is there much of a difference?
Well, you know, I think in Western culture today, those words are treated as synonyms most of the time, but there actually is a distinction if you look at the way they were originally defined. The term supernatural really originates from Latin, supranaturalis. It just really means the transcendence of the natural realm, you know, supernature. Mm-hmm. The paranormal denotes something that lies outside the range of science. It's just kind of outside the range of a natural explanation. But, you know, one day it might have one. It's just that we haven't found one yet. So while supernatural are always paranormal in the technical sense, the paranormal are not always supernatural. For example, like if extrasensory perception, if it turns out to be a human ability, then it's paranormal, but not necessarily supernatural. But in contrast, you know, God sending an angel to speak through a prophet or something like that would be a supernatural event.
You went to the Rhine Research Center when you were researching this latest book, The Supernatural Worldview. What did you think about them, and what were your views on some of the things that they were doing?
Well, George, you know, I've always been interested in parapsychology and, you know, in strange phenomena and things like that. And, you know, I have an open mind as far as looking at these things. And I kind of already was of the perception that perhaps things like ESP were real. To really understand another worldview, you know, the best way to do that is to go directly to the source. And so to gain a working knowledge of parapsychology, I enrolled as a student at the Rhine Research Center. It's the teaching arm of the Rhine Research Center, and it's in Durham, North Carolina. It's kind of what remains of the famous Duke Parapsychology Lab that was founded by J.B.
Right.
and Louisa Rhine at Duke in the early 20th century.
They did some great work there, didn't they?
They really did. And, you know, and he kind of started with spiritual convictions, and what Ryan really wanted to do was to use science to really prove these things, because he was kind of fed up with the materialist skepticism even back in the early 20th century. And so a lot of intellectuals really considered ESP to be a proven phenomenon in the mid-20th century due to his work. And, you know, truthfully, it was never really debunked. All that ever happened was, you know, a couple of clever skeptics kind of just figured out some ways that you could assert that perhaps some of his best subjects had cheated. They didn't prove that they cheated. They just found a possible way they could have. And just by asserting that, they kind of dismissed his a whole body of research. But I don't really think that's a valid criteria to just dismiss it all. So, I went there and I took a introduction to parapsychology class with Nancy Zingroni and Carlos Alvarado, and then I studied paranormal investigation with Lloyd Auerbach, and I believe he's been a guest on the show.
Oh, absolutely. Sure has.
And, you know, Lloyd takes a really scientific approach to investigating paranormal claims, and he's not a real big fan of most of the TV shows because, frankly, you know, when you have to go and, you know, discover some kind of exciting paranormal phenomenon to put on TV every week, there's enormous incentive to kind of ham it up a little bit because, you know, the paranormal is not the sort of thing that performs on demand, which makes it relatively hard to study in a lab. And so Lloyd he was a great teacher in a lot of ways. He asked a lot of thought-provoking questions like, where do ghosts get their clothes?
Well, that is a good question, right?
Yeah.
And why do they
and
have
how
them?
Do they talk? And that if they don't have vocal cords and they don't have lungs pushing air through their throats, where do their voices come from? It seems to suggest that perhaps they're communicating perhaps in a telepathic way rather than sound waves.
Now, Let's talk a little bit more about the Rhine Institute and what can they do to contribute to the knowledge of the supernatural. Is there anything else they could do?
There's a lot of people doing exciting work in parapsychology right now. I know that Carlos and Nancy are doing some work with near-death experiences. I also looked at a lot of the work that's being done at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Dr. Dean Radin is doing some very exciting work.
Great stuff there, too.
Really, really is. And, you know, I think that some of these phenomenon are becoming proven entities. I think the one that I think is probably the best evidence right now is Dean Radin's work on what he calls, it's a study of premonitions. He calls it presentiment. That's just kind of a fancy word for a premonition. But he designed an experiment where they set a subject in front of a computer screen, and it flashes a standard set of psychological images by, and most of them are mundane kind of images, perhaps a field full of grass, a pencil laying on the desk. And then, you know, every once in a while, there's a highly charged emotional image, perhaps something very violent, like a car accident, okay? And so the subject is hooked up to a bunch of monitoring equipment, heart rate, blood pressure, and one of the things Radin does is he measures skin conductivity. So if you sweat just a little bit, it increases the electrical conductivity on your skin.
That's
so
like you're the galvanic up skin, yeah.
Right, right. So you're hooked up to all this gear, and, you know, so you get a flat baseline, these mundane images flash by on the screen, and then you hit a, you know, an evocative image, and of course the graph spikes way up, you know, indicating that you have an emotional reaction. Well, the thing that they have consistently discovered is that the reaction begins 5 to 2 seconds before you see the image. Okay, before. Suggesting that
a little remote viewing almost?
Before they see it, before, even really before the computer selects it by a random number generator, sometimes people start to react. They're anticipating the future by 5 to 2 seconds, and it's consistent with odds against chance of like 125,000 to 1. And it's been repeated in 3 or 4 different laboratories by different scientists around the world. So it's really becoming rock solid that something very interesting is going on.
And what are they doing, Chris? Is it remote viewing?
Well, we call it, you know, precognition, or he calls it presentiment. The thing that I find the most fascinating about this one, and the reason I really kind of emphasize it, is that it's unconscious. You know, people aren't consciously doing this. It's something they're not even aware of necessarily. And I think, you know, most people experience this. If you think about it, I mean, how many times have you heard, I had a bad feeling, so I decided not to go there that day, or I felt
out.
Like I needed
that's
to change right. lanes. Yeah, there you go.
Well, that's happened to me too, Chris, it's a very serious, serious situation. The Supernatural Worldview. Where do we get your book, Chris?
Well, it's my publisher actually is running a special right now where you get my first two books, Petrus Romanus and Exo Vaticana, about the Vatican ET connection. He'll throw those in free when you buy The Supernatural Worldview.
Free? Nothing wrong with free.
3 books for the price of 1. So at www.supernaturalworldview.com, you'll find the links to get in on that deal. And it's also available to Amazon and the typical outlets.
All right, Chris, we're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM and talk about extrasensory perception. And also, we've got to spend some time talking about ancient prophecies as well. Hey, I invite you all to watch our television program, Beyond Belief. It is free for 10 days. Then you can look at all the many videos that are available as well. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com and you'll find links, or go directly to that website, beyondbelief.com. That's beyondbelief.com. Okay, welcome back. Chris Putnam with us, author of The Supernatural Worldview. Chris, you have looked at and you discuss in that work ESP, extrasensory perception, psi as well. Explain the tie-in there.
Certainly. So, you know, we already mentioned presentiment, this idea of premonitions. So that would be a psi ability. You know, the word psi, it's based on the Greek letter psi, mm-hmm. and it's really just kind of a placeholder. It's a variable that denotes, you know, this extrasensory ability that parapsychologists are investigating, and because they don't really have a definite theory on how it works or exactly what it is, they just kind of label it psi. So that's all that is. And, you know, as we talked about before, I think J.B. Rhine really did accumulate some really strong evidence that ESP is real. And one of the experiments I talk about in the book was he had a subject, you know, his name was Hubert Pierce. So one of the hypotheses in my book that I kind of emphasize is that I believe that these are really natural human abilities. And it's interesting that, you know, when a lot of times Christians tend to demonize a lot of this stuff, and I think that's unfortunate because I don't think it necessarily implies anything occult or anything like that. I really do feel like it's just a natural talent that some have more than others. Now, there was a Christian writer in the early 20th century, really contemporary of Rhine. He was a Chinese author named Watchman Nee, and he wrote a book called The Latent Powers of the Soul, and that was really his idea as well, is that these are, you know, he kind of connected it to the biblical Adam. Mm-hmm. And his idea was that, you know, when Adam fell, you know, from God's favor, when they disobeyed, that he actually lost a lot more than just the real estate of the Garden of Eden. That he, you know, in that account, if you read, you know, it says that Adam was able to walk with God in the garden, and he seemed to have a pretty free access to the spirit realm, the way he communicated with God and whatnot. So Watchman Nee hypothesized that, you know, he had these psi abilities to, you know, a very developed degree, and that part of, you know, the fall was that he lost that access. He lost those abilities. They kind of went latent and kind of went dormant in mankind. And so that we all still have a trace of them. We just don't necessarily know how to access them, and some people perhaps have that ability more than others. Now, you know, whether or not he's completely right about connecting it to the fall of man, I don't know, but I do think that there's plenty of evidence that some people have more than others, and that it just seems to be a natural thing. The presentiment research, because it's unconscious and people aren't really trying to do it, really does indicate that it's a natural thing. You know, it's mm-hmm. not magic. It's not a cult. It's just something that people are able to have these premonitions. Now, as far as, you know, ESP proper, you know, trying to concentrate and to pick on something, there was a Duke Divinity student, you know, studying to be a pastor at Duke University, who was one of Rhine's star subjects. His name was Hubert Pierce. Now, he was able to do really well with the Zener deck, and that was a deck of, you know, 25 ESP cards with the different symbols, a circle, a star, square, wavy lines, and a cross.
And he had to picture those or something?
Right. So the typical experiment, you know, would be someone would hold, flip a card over and then have the other person perceive what it was.
Yeah.
But Rhine, you know, was always trying to make his test really rigorous scientifically. So what they actually did with Pierce is they weren't even in the same building. They had Pierce go into a different building in the library up in the study carrels where he couldn't even see the building where the cards were, and they had synchronized their watches where they would flip the card over and leave it flipped for like 3 seconds and then flip the next one. And so Pierce knew when they were going to start, and he would just start writing down what he thought each card was. So they're literally not even in the same building. Now, the thing that was astounding is that he scored really well on these. He was typically 30% correct. 558 hits when 370 were expected by chance. And so that's 10% more than 20% that you would expect from chance. So the odds against that, when they look at it and calculate the odds, are like 10,000 to 1 against chance that he would be that accurate. Now, that was pretty consistent with him. Sometimes he got nearly a perfect score, but overall, you know, they would kind of get it down to this where it was like 125,000 to one. And, you know, that's a pretty astounding hit rate. Now,
it
the
sure
thing
is.
Was interesting. Yeah. He, as he got older, it seemed to fade. They tested him again, like in 1950, and he couldn't do it anymore. So when he was a young student, he had this ability, and he actually said his mother had it, and you know, she had psychic ability. So it seems to run in families, and it seems to be natural.
What do you think, Chris, people are tapping into in order to have this ability? I mean, is there some kind of ether in the universe? And, you know, it's, as I've always called it, the wireless internet where everything's connected. What are they tapping into?
That's a really good question, George. You know, I think that's the mystery that parapsychologists are really trying to solve. And no one has a definite answer. I think the way you described it sounds pretty compelling, that it is kind of like, you know, this some sort of signal that you're picking up on. You know, another word for it is clairvoyance. And you know, there's actually different ways you could pick this up. You know, is, you know, some perhaps they're reading the mind of the person that's looking at the card. Or perhaps they're projecting their consciousness to the room where that person mm-hmm. is, and then they see the card. So, you know, you don't know which one it is. It's really impossible to know. Is it clairvoyance or is it telepathy? It could actually be either one. And it's really hard to rule out, you know, either. It could be both.
It could be. And you have looked at, you know, without this getting too biblical, Psi has been found in the Bible, and it seems to be predominant throughout the Bible, isn't it?
Well, you know, that's what I was looking at, George. You know, I wanted to, you know, be fair with this data and to look at these things and say, you know, is there any place in the Bible where I see things like this happening? And I think so. I mean, like with telepathy, with mind-to-mind communication, I think it's clear that at least angels are able to do this with humans. If you recall, in the gospel narrative, when Mary got pregnant, and of course Joseph was very concerned, his wife-to-be is pregnant, and he knows that he hasn't slept with her.
Yeah, right? That could be a problem.
Yeah, and so Joseph's very worried, and he goes to sleep at night, and it says an angel, you know, came to Joseph in his dream and told him, you know, Joseph, don't be concerned because your wife, you know, has become pregnant by the Holy Spirit. And you know, this is the assurance that he gets, but it's communicated to him in a dream. So that sounds like telepathy to me. You know, so here we have an example that angels can do it. And I think it's even more interesting. Now, if Joseph is able to communicate back to that angel in the dream, that would indicate that he's able to send the signal. So at least we see that angels have this ability to project into our thought life. Now, of course, that can get a little disturbing when you start thinking about the possibility that fallen angels might be doing it as well.
Well, that's right. And they could, couldn't they?
I think so. I think that that's probably the way demons would tempt people, you know, by planting temptations and ideas in our heads that way.
Back to this Asian watchman, Nee. What other kind of predictions did he make?
Well, really interestingly, he predicted that he really thought that in the end times, as the events in the book of Revelation would start to come to pass, that you know, Satan would ramp up his efforts. There's a passage in Revelation 18 where it talks about the souls of men becoming a commodity. And he attached that to this idea that these latent powers of the soul, these natural abilities in humans, he really thought that there would be a ramping up of people trying to develop these, and that Satan would use this as a way to kind of enter into the material world through people, you know, by kind of commandeering these latent soul powers and using them for his own ends. So he predicted that the world would become increasingly psychic. He really saw that as a component of the end time scenario, that people would start developing these abilities. So I kind of, you know, took that to heart and started looking around at what's going on, and a lot of what he was talking about seems to be occurring. And, you know, I don't think that any of these parapsychologists have any kind of malevolent intentions or anything like that, and I'm not accusing them of anything of that nature.
But they might. But they might, right?
Well, some could. But, you know, I think most of them are innocently just trying to investigate this phenomenon. But, you know, that doesn't mean that they might get used by a diabolical plan, especially if they don't really believe in Satan and they're not looking out for it. He could, you know, twist their work to his ends. Now, you know, are there, you know, parapsychologists promoting the development of these abilities? Well, yeah, that's actually Dean Radin's last book is called Supernormal. And you probably had him on the show about that.
Oh, I wouldn't doubt. Sure.
And, you know, the book is advocating Eastern meditation as a means to develop ESP. And, you know, I don't know, but that's exactly the sort of thing that Watchman Nee was talking about.
Chris, you think that demonic activity is on the uptick, don't you?
Yeah, I do. And when I started writing this book, probably a couple years ago, I didn't really know if that was just a speculation or, you know, but I had a feeling that it was. But as it's kind of come along in the last couple of years, and right as I was finishing the book up last winter, I was really convinced of it. And the reason why is just you see such a rise in interest in paranormal things, but I've seen a really rise in this just overtly evil phenomenon. I wrote a chapter in the book that deals with this, and there was an article that popped up in a Christian website called Extreme Manifestations of Demons Increasing Worldwide, and it just cited case after case after case. And I have one footnote in that chapter that probably has 20 different articles. Now, George, you know, one of the things that I think is really clearly demonic, and it's very pervasive in culture, I connected it to the prophets of Baal. And that's kind of an obscure reference to the Bible, where the prophet Elijah was challenging the prophets of Baal about their god Baal, and Baal wasn't showing up to perform to the challenge. And so the prophets of Baal started cutting their arms, and they were basically, you know, bloodletting as a way to kind of get Baal to come. And of course, Baal never really showed up to that challenge. But so I asked this question in the book, you know, why are American children behaving like the prophets of Baal? And what I'm speaking about is this just really kind of crazy rise in what we call self-harm. My wife works at a school for troubled girls. It's a boarding school. And she estimates that probably over 50% of those girls self-harm in that they cut their arms and legs and slash themselves with razors and knives as a means to escape emotional pain. Now, when I was a kid in high school, I'd never heard of anybody doing this. But I've looked around at the sort of statistics that sociologists and people are looking at, and they see up to 25% of teenagers are doing this now. I have a hard time explaining that in a natural way. I don't see the payoff. I don't see the pleasure in cutting yourself. But why is this becoming so popular? George, I'm afraid that, you know, we've kind of seen a diminishing of the Christian consensus in the West. And I really think that as that has faded, that some of the restraint has been lifted in our culture, and that we're seeing a rise in demonic powers in cultural influence. And I really think that that explains that. Now, it's really hard to prove that, but it's hard for me to find a natural explanation for why teenagers want to harm themselves in that way.
Do you see Satan behind this?
I do. You know, Jesus said that he comes to steal and destroy, and, you know, he seems to have a vested interest in harming people and making them harm themselves. And, you know, that just to me is just an overtly demonic sort of thing. And then you look at the rise in things like mass shootings. They really do seem to be on the increase. Some sorts of evil seem to defy a natural explanation. Like, you know, we just had this guy who walked into a kindergarten and shot 20 little kids. Now, it's really hard for me to imagine what, you know, why a man would come to do that on his own. I really do feel like that there's some sort of demonic influence inspiring some of these events that we're seeing that are just kind of becoming common. I mean, just in the last few years, we've had quite a few mass shootings that...
What do you think is causing all this bizarre behavior?
Well, George, you know, I don't want to just, you know, kind of wave my hand and blame it all on demons, but I really do think that there is a hedge of protection that God kind of puts on a nation when they honor him, when their positions of power and the structure of that nation honors the Lord. I think that there is a protecting, hedging influence, and I think that is being lifted in our country now, and so we're seeing a rise in these sorts of phenomenon.
Yeah, I think so, by leaps and bounds. Let's talk a little bit about prophecy. Apocalyptic prophecy, Chris, as you have written about and you continue to write about. How bad is it going to get?
Well, if you take the book of Revelation seriously, it's going to get pretty bad. It's going to take out quite a few people. But one of the things that I really have been studying, a lot of scholars will say that Revelation 12, it's a chapter right in the middle, is really the hinge pin to the book of Revelation. Now, in that account, there is a war in heaven, and it talks about the angel Michael and his angels fighting Satan and his minions. And, you know, there have been varying opinions on when this is. Some scholars would say that it happened at the time of the crucifixion at the cross. But the end result of that war is that Satan is cast to earth. Now, I used to sort of think maybe it happened at the cross, but then the more I've studied it, I've become really convinced that it's a future event. And, you know, the way things stand today, it could be ongoing, actually. We don't really know how that war lasts, how long it lasts. But the reason I came to the conclusion where I really decisively decided to think that it was a future event rather than something that happened in the past, it says Satan is cast to earth, and, you know, woe to you on the earth, for the devil has come down in great wrath, and he knows his time is short. Now, it's hard to think that happened back in AD 70, and, you know, his short time has been ongoing the whole time. I don't think that's the case. And also, there's a hymn that is sung in heaven. And, you know, the things that are celebrated in that hymn really haven't come to pass yet. So I think that's a future prophecy. So if that's the case, you know, I think that we would expect a rise in demonic phenomenon worldwide, that we would see an increase in all sorts of things like this.
And we are.
The devil knows that his time is short. Yes, I think that might be indicative that this war in heaven is ongoing. Now, I don't know what that's going to look like when the devil is cast to earth. I have an expectation that we'll start to see the supernatural manifest in ways that people have never imagined. But I do think there's some really strong indicators that we are seeing this. I've talked about the massacres. I've talked about, you know, the rise in things like self-harm. There's been a rise in all sorts of occult things. But, you know, did you hear about the Ammons case in Indiana this year? Do you remember that one?
Let's take the break, and then we'll come back, Chris, in just a moment. Chris Putnam with us, The Supernatural Worldview. We will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.